acceptance. Good. Well, I guess you should get home. Your tribute's still in the games, right? Asked Mr. Plinth. Thrown by the dismissal, Coriolanus rose from his chair. Oh, yes, you're right. Just wanted to check on Sejanus. Will he be back to school soon? No telling, said Mr. Plinth. But thanks for stopping by. Of course, tell him he's missed, said Coriolanus. Good night. Night. Mr. Plinth gave him a nod. No money? Not even a handshake. Coriolanus left off balance and disappointed. The heavy bag of food and the chauffeur assigned to drive him home made a decent consolation prize, but in the end his visit had been a waste of time, especially when Dr. Gall's paper still awaited him. The nice addition to your prize application. Why did everything have to be an uphill battle for him? Coriolanus told Tigris he'd checked on Sejanus, and she didn't press him for further explanation of his lateness. She made him a cup of the special jasmine tea, an indulgence like splurging on the tokens, but who cared now? He settled down to work, writing the three C words on a scrap of paper. Chaos, control, and what was the third? Oh yes, contract. What happened if no one was in control of humanity? That was the topic he was supposed to address, and he had said there was chaos. And Dr. Gall had said to start there. Chaos. Extreme disorder and confusion. Like being in the arena, Dr. Gall had said. That wonderful opportunity, she had called it. Transformative. Coriolanus thought about what it had felt like to be in the arena, where there were no rules, no laws, no consequences to one's actions. The needle of his moral compass had swung madly without direction. Fueled by the terror of being prey, how quickly he himself had become a predator, with no reservations about smashing Bobbin to death. He'd transformed, all right, but not into anything he was proud of. And being a Snow, he had more self-control than most. He tried to imagine what it would be like if the whole world played by those same rules. No consequences. People taking what they wanted, when they wanted, and killing for it if it came to that. Survival driving everything. There had been days during the war when they'd all been too scared to leave the apartment. Days when the lawlessness had made even the capital an arena. Yes, the lack of law, that was at the heart of it. So people needed to agree on laws to follow. Was that what Dr. Gall had meant by social contract? The agreement not to rob, abuse, or kill one another? It had to be. And the law required enforcement, and that was where control came in. Without the control to enforce the contract, chaos reigned. The power that controlled needed to be greater than the people. Otherwise, they would challenge it. The only entity capable of this was the capital. It took him until about 2 in the morning to sort that out, and then it barely filled a page. Dr. Gall would want more, but that was all he could manage tonight. He crawled into bed, where he dreamed of Lucy Gray being hunted by the rainbow snakes. He awoke with a start, trembling to the strains of the anthem. You have got to hold yourself together, he told himself. The games can't last much longer. The breakfast delights provided by Mrs. Plinth gave him a boost into day 4 of the Hunger Games. On the trolley, he gorged himself on a slice of blackberry pie, a sausage roll, and a cheese tart. Between the games and the Plinths, his waistband was becoming snug. He would make an effort to walk home. Velvet ropes cordoned off the section of the dais with the 8 remaining mentors, and now a sign with the occupant's name hung on the back of each chair. Assigned seating. That was new, but probably an attempt to mitigate some of the snarkiness that had sprung up in the last few days. Coriolanus remained in the back row between Io and Urban. Poor Festus was sandwiched between Vipsania and Clemencia. Lucky welcomed the audience with the long-suffering Jubilee, who'd been confined in a cage more suited to a rabbit than a bird. Nothing stirred in the arena, and the tribute seemed to be sleeping in. The only new development was that someone, likely Reaper, had dragged Jessup's body to the line of the dead near the barricade. Coriolanus nervously awaited the announcement of Gaius Breen's death, but no word was forthcoming. The game makers spent time with the crowd in front of the arena, which continued to expand. The different fan clubs now sported shirts with tribute and mentor faces, and Coriolanus felt both pleased and embarrassed to see his image staring back at him from the giant screen. Not until mid-morning did the first tribute make an appearance, and it took the audience a moment to place her. "It's Wovi!" Hilarius shouted in relief. "She's alive!" Coriolanus remembered the child as scrawny, but now she looked skeletal. Her arms and legs like sticks, her cheeks sunken. She crouched at the mouth of a tunnel in her filthy striped dress, squinting into the sunlight and clutching an empty water bottle. "Hold on, Wovi! Food's on the way!" said Hilarius, hammering away at his cuff. She couldn't have much in the way of sponsors, but there was always someone willing to place a bet on a long shot. Lepidus swooped in, and Hilarius spoke at length about Wovi's merits. He presented her absence as stealth, claiming it had been their strategy all along for her to hide and let the field clear. And look at her! Here she is in the final eight! As a half-dozen drones sped across the arena toward her, Hilarius became even more excited. "There's her food and water now! All she has to do is grab it and get back in hiding." As the supplies showered her, Wovi lifted her hands but seemed in a daze. She pawed at the ground, located a bottle of water, and struggled to unscrew the cap. After a few gulps, she sank back against the wall and gave a small belch. A thin stream of silverish liquid trickled out of the side of her mouth, and then she went still. The audience watched uncomprehendingly for a minute.
"She's dead," announced Urban.
"No, no, she's not dead. She's just resting," said Hilarius. But the longer Wovi stared unblinkingly into the bright sunlight, the harder that was to believe. Coriolanus examined her spittle, neither clear nor bloody, but slightly off, and wondered if Lucy Gray had finally managed to put the rat poison to use. It would have been easy to poison the last swallow of water in a bottle and discard it in one of the tunnels. Desperate Wovi would not have thought twice about downing it. But no one else, not even Hilarius, seemed to find anything amiss.
"I don't know," said Lepidus to Hilarius. "I think your friend might be right."
They waited another 10 long minutes without a flicker of life from Wovi before Hilarius gave in and lifted his chair. Lepidus heaped on the praise, and Hilarius, while disappointed, reckoned things could have gone a lot worse. She managed to hang in there a long time, given her condition. "I wish she'd have come out sooner so I could have fed her, but I feel like I can hold my head up. The final eight is nothing to sneeze at." Coriolanus mentally checked his list. Both tributes from three, both from four, and Treach and Reaper. That was all that stood between Lucy Gray and victory. Six tributes, and a fair amount of luck. Wovi's death went unnoticed for a while in the arena. It was almost lunchtime when Reaper came out from the barricade, still wearing his flag cape. He approached Wovi warily, but she had posed no threat alive, and she certainly didn't dead. Reaper crouched beside her and picked up an apple, then frowned as he examined her face more closely. "He knows," thought Coriolanus. "He at least suspects that it wasn't a natural death." Reaper dropped the apple, lifted Wovi into his arms, and headed to the dead tributes, abandoning the food and water on the ground. "You see," Clemencia asked no one in particular, "you see what I'm dealing with? My tribute's mentally unbalanced."
"I guess you're right," said Festus. "Sorry about earlier." And that was it.
Wovi's death caused no suspicion outside the arena, and inside it only Reaper questioned the cause. Lucy Gray was not prone to carelessness. Perhaps she'd even chosen frail Wovey as a target because the child's already grave condition would mask the poisoning. He felt frustrated by his inability to communicate with her and update their strategy together. With so few left, was hiding still the best approach? Or would it be better for her to act more aggressively? Of course, he didn't know. She could be planting poisoned food and water at this very moment, in which case she'd need more, which he couldn't provide if she didn't make an appearance. Although he didn't believe in it, he tried to channel her telepathically. "Let me help, Lucy Gray. Or at least let me see that you're all right," he thought. Then added, "I miss you." Reaper had returned to the tunnels by the time District 4 scavenged Wovey's food. Their absolute lack of concern with its origin reassured Coriolanus that the possibility of poisoning had flown under the radar. They sat right down where Wovey died and gobbled up every bite. Then they strolled back to their tunnel. Mizzen walked with a limp, but he would still outmatch most of the remaining tributes if it came to a fight. Coriolanus wondered if in the end it would all come down to Coral and Mizzen deciding which District 4 tribute took home the crown. In all his years, Coriolanus had never left a school lunch unfinished, but the cardboard bowls of lima beans on noodles turned his stomach. Still full from the plinth's breakfast, he just couldn't bring himself to swallow even a spoonful, and it required a quick exchange of his untouched bowl with Festus's empty one to avoid a reprimand. "Here, lima beans still taste like the war to me." "That's me and oatmeal. One whiff and I want to hide in a bunker," said Festus, who made quick work of the stuff. "Thanks. I overslept and missed breakfast." Coriolanus hoped the lima beans hadn't been a bad omen. Then he admonished himself. This was no time to start embracing superstitions. He needed to keep his wits sharp, stay personable for the cameras, and get through the day. Lucy Gray must be getting hungry by now. He planned his next food delivery while he sipped his water. With Hilarius gone, the three remaining mentor chairs in the back row had been centered, and Coriolanus resumed his seat in the middle. It was, as Demetia had called it, like a game of musical chairs, and these were the very people he'd played with during childhood. If he ever had children, and he planned to one day, would they still be among the elite capital social club? Or would they be relegated to lesser circles? It would help if they had a wider family network to draw on, but he and Tigris were the only Snows of their generation. Without her, he'd be headed into the future all alone. Little occurred in the arena that afternoon. Coriolanus watched for Lucy Gray, hoping for a chance to feed her, but she remained elusive. The audience outside the arena provided most of the excitement when Coral fans mixed it up with Treach fans over who was worthiest to be crowned victor. A few punches were thrown before the peacekeeper separated the two groups, sending them to opposite sides of the crowd. Coriolanus felt glad his own fans had a little more class. In late afternoon, when Lucky resumed his coverage, Dr. Gall sat across from him holding Jubilee in his cage. The bird rocked back and forth like a small child trying to comfort itself. Lucky eyed his pet with worry, perhaps anticipating its loss to the labs. "We have a special guest with us today, head game maker Dr. Gall, who's been making friends with Jubilee. I hear you have some sad news for us, Dr. Gall." Dr. Gall moved Jubilee's cage to the table. "Yes. Due to injuries sustained in the rebel bombing of the arena, another of our academy students, Gaius Breen, has died." As his classmates cried out, Coriolanus tried to center himself. Any minute he might be called upon to respond to Gaius's death, but that wasn't the source of his anxiety. Gaius would be easy enough to eulogize. He hadn't an enemy in the world. "I think I speak for everyone when I say we extend our sympathies to the family," said Lucky. Dr. Gall's face hardened. "We do. But actions speak louder than words, and our rebel enemies seem somewhat hard of hearing. In response,
We've planned something special for their children in the arena.
Shall we tune in? Said Lucky. In the center of the arena, Tesley and Cirque squatted over a pile of rubble, poking around for who knew what. Apparently they held no interest for Reaper, who sat high in the stands, his back to the arena wall, wrapped in his cape. Suddenly, Treach burst out of a tunnel and bore down on the District 3 tributes, who fled for the barricade. Murmurs of confusion came from the audience. Where was the something special promised by Dr. Gall? They were answered by the sight of an oversized drone flying into the arena, transporting the Rainbow Snake Tank. Coriolanus had all but convinced himself that the snake attack had been a product of an overheated imagination, but the entry of the tank ended that. His brain had assembled the puzzle pieces in exactly the right order. What he didn't know was how the snakes would respond to being unleashed, but he'd been in the lab. Dr. Gall did not breed lapdogs. She designed weapons. The unusual package caught Treach's attention. Perhaps he thought some extra special gift had been earmarked for him, because he halted as the drone reached the middle of the arena. Tesley and Cirque paused as well, and even Reaper rose to observe the delivery. The drone released the uncovered tank about 10 yards above the ground. Rather than shattering, the container bounced on impact. Then, like a flower opening its petals, its walls fell to the ground. Snakes shot out in all directions, creating a multicolored sunburst in the dust. In the front row, Clemencia jumped to her feet and let out a blood-curdling scream, almost causing Festus to fall out of his chair. As most people were only just registering the new development on the screen, her reaction seemed extreme. Afraid that Clemencia would spill the whole story in her panic, Coriolanus leaped up and wrapped his arms around her from behind, not sure if the move was meant to be comforting or confining. Clemencia went rigid but silent. "They're not here. They're in the arena," Coriolanus said in her ear. "You're safe." But he continued to hold on to her as the action unfolded. Maybe Treach's Lumber District background had given him some familiarity with snakes. The second they erupted from the tank, he turned on his heel and sprinted for the stands. He bounced up the debris hill like a goat and kept moving, hurtling over seats as he ascended. The few moments of confusion that Tesley and Cirque experienced came at a great cost. Tesley made it to one of the poles and managed to shinny up a few yards to safety, but Cirque stumbled over a rusty old spear and the snakes overtook him. A dozen pairs of fangs pierced his body, and then, as if satisfied, the snakes moved on. Pink, yellow, and blue streaked his body as the wounds pumped out bright pus. Smaller than Clemencia, with double the venom in his system, Cirque struggled to breathe for about 10 seconds before he died. Tesley stared at his fallen body and sobbed in terror as she clung to the pole. Below her, the delicate snakes bunched, rearing up, and dancing around the base. Lucky's voiceover boomed above the scene. "What's happening?"
"These are mutations we've developed in our labs in the capital," Dr. Gall informed the audience. "They're only snakelets, but full grown, they'll easily outrun a human, and that post will be no problem for them to climb. They're designed to hunt humans and reproduce rapidly, so any casualties can be swiftly replaced."
By this time, Treach had climbed out onto the narrow shelf over the scoreboard, and Reaper had found refuge on the roof of the press box. The few snakes that had managed to scale the rubble into the stands gathered below them. The mics picked up the muted sounds of a girl's scream.
"They got Lucy Gray," Coriolanus thought in despair. "The handkerchief didn't work."
But just then, Mizzen exploded from the tunnel nearest the barricade, followed by a shrieking choral. A single snake dangled from her arm. She tore it free, but dozens charged for her the moment it hit the ground, targeting her lower legs. Mizzen flung away his trident and made a flying leap to gain the pole across from Tesley. Despite his bad knee, he halved his previous time climbing to the top. From there, he witnessed Coral's frantic but blissfully short end. With the targets on the ground disposed of, most of the snakes regrouped under Tesley. Her grip on the pole began to fail, and she cried out to Mizzen for help, but he only shook his head, more stunned than malicious. People in the audience began shushing each other then, although Coriolanus did not know why. As the hall quieted, he picked up on what sharper ears had detected. Somewhere, ever so faintly, someone was singing in the arena. His girl. Lucy Gray emerged from her tunnel, moving in slow motion and backward. She lifted each foot with care as she stepped behind herself, swaying gently to the rhythm of her music.
La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la.
That was the extent of the lyrics at the moment, but it was compelling nonetheless. Following her, as if mesmerized by the melody, came half a dozen snakes. Coriolanus released Clemencia, who had calmed down, giving her a gentle push in Festus's direction. He stepped toward the screen, holding his breath as Lucy Gray continued to back in and then curve around toward where Jessup's body had lain. Her voice became louder as she, knowingly or not, worked her way back to the mic. Perhaps for one last song, one last performance. None of the snakes were inclined to attack her, though. In fact, she seemed to be drawing them from around the arena. The bunch under Tesley's pole thinned, a few dropped from the stands, and dozens slithered out of the tunnels to join in a general migration to Lucy Gray. They surrounded her, flocking in from all sides, making it impossible for her to continue retreating. The bright bodies undulated over her bare feet, curling around her ankles as she lowered herself gently onto a chunk of marble. With the tips of her fingers, she spread her ruffles out in the dust, as if by way of invitation. As the snakes swarmed her, the faded fabric vanished, leaving her with a brilliant skirt of weaving reptiles.
Chapter 20. Coriolanus squeezed his hands into fists, unsure of the viper's intentions. The snakes in the tank, having been exposed to his scent on the proposal, had entirely ignored him, but these seemed magnetically drawn to his tribute. Could it be that the environment made the difference? Violently released from the warm, close quarters of their tank into the vast, unsheltered arena, were they seeking her out as the only familiar scent they could find? Had they gravitated to her to harbor in the safety of her skirt? Lucy Gray knew nothing of this, because that day in the zoo when he'd meant to tell her about Clemencia and the snakes, her circumstances had been so much worse than his own that he'd kept silent on the subject. Even if he had told her, it would be a real leap of faith in his abilities to imagine he'd found a way to tamper with the snakes in the games. What did she think was keeping them in check? It had to be her singing. Had she sung to the snakes at home?
"That snake was a particular friend of mine," she told the little girl in the zoo.
Perhaps she'd befriended several snakes back in District 12. Perhaps she thought if she stopped singing, they would indeed kill her now. Perhaps this was her swan song. She would never want to go out without a finale. She would want to die with her boots on, in the brightest spotlight she could find. When Lucy Gray began the lyrics, her voice was soft, but clear as a bell.
"You're headed for heaven, the sweet old hereafter, and I've got one foot in the door. But before I can fly up, I've loose ends to tie up, right here in the old there before."
An old song, Coriolanus thought, with talk of the hereafter, which reminded him of Sejanus and his breadcrumbs, but also that funny line about the there before. That must mean the present, here, now, while she was still alive.
"I'll be along when I've finished my song. When I've shut down the band, when I've played out my hand, when I've paid all my debts, when I have no regrets. right here in the old there before, when nothing is left anymore.
The game makers cut to a longer shot, which made Coriolanus want to shout an objection until he realized why. Every snake in the arena appeared to have fallen subject to her siren song and flocked to her. Even those in the nest under Tesli, who was ready prey, had abandoned their target and made for Lucy Gray. Still shuddering from the trauma, Tesli slid shakily to the ground and hobbled over to a chain-link fence on one section of the barricade. She climbed her way to a safe height while the song continued.
I'll catch you up when I've emptied my cup, when I've worn out my friends, when I've burned out both ends, when I've cried all my tears, when I've conquered my fears, right here in the old there before, when nothing is left anymore.
The camera made its way back to a tight shot of Lucy Gray. Coriolanus had the feeling that she usually catered to an audience well plied with liquor. In the days before her interview, he'd listened to many a number that conjured up a drunken group waving tin cups of gin from side to side in some dive bar. Although the liquor didn't seem essential, because when he took a quick look over his shoulder, he saw that several people in Heavensby Hall had begun to sway to her rhythm. Her voice rose in volume, echoing around the arena.
I'll bring the news, when I've danced off my shoes, when my body's closed down, when my boat's run aground, when I've tallied the score and I'm flat on the floor, right here in the old there before, when nothing is left anymore.
And then reaching a crescendo as she brought it home.
When I'm pure like a dove, when I've learned how to love, right here in the old there before, when nothing is left anymore.
The last note hung in the air while the audience held its collective breath. The snakes waited for it to fade and then, or was it his imagination, began to stir. Lucy Gray responded by softly humming, as if to a restless baby. The viewers quietly relaxed as the snakes relaxed around her. Lucky looked as spellbound as the snakes when the cameras cut back to him, eyes a bit glazed, mouth slackly open. He snapped back when he saw his own image on the feed and turned his attention to a stone-faced Dr. Gall. Well, head game maker, take a bow! Heavensby Hall erupted into a standing ovation, but Coriolanus could not peel his eyes off Dr. Gall. What was going on behind that inscrutable expression? Did she attribute the snake's behavior to Lucy Gray's singing? Or did she suspect foul play? Even if Dr. Gall knew about the handkerchief, perhaps she would forgive him, as the result had been so dramatic. Dr. Gall allowed herself a small nod of acknowledgement.
Thank you. But the focus today should not be on me, but on Gaius Breen. Perhaps his classmates might share some remembrances with us.
Lepidus leaped into action in Heavensby Hall, collecting stories from Gaius's classmates. It was well that Dr. Gall had given him a heads up, because while everybody had a joke or a funny story to share, only Coriolanus managed to tie in the heroic loss, the snakes, and the retribution they had witnessed in the arena. We could never let the death of such a stellar youth of the capital go without repercussions. When hit, we hit back twice as hard, just as Dr. Gall has mentioned in the past. Lepidus tried to turn the conversation to Lucy Gray's extraordinary performance with the snakes, but Coriolanus only said, "She's remarkable, but Dr. Gall is right. This moment belongs to Gaius. Let's save Lucy Gray for tomorrow." After a full half hour of remembrance, Lepidus bid the show's adieus to Festus and Io, as Coral and Cirque had succumbed to venom. Coriolanus gave Festus a bear hug, surprisingly emotional at seeing his reliable friend leave the dais. He felt the loss of Io as well, since she veered more toward clinical than combative, which was more than he could say for the others remaining. Except perhaps Persephone, who he decided to share his supper hour with. Cannibals over cutthroats. The student body went home, leaving the handful of active mentors to their steak dinners. Coriolanus glanced around at his competitors. Being in the final five, he should have been flying high. But if one of the others won, Dean Highbottom could still give him a prize that was insufficient to pay for university, perhaps citing the demerit as his reason. Only the plinth prize would truly protect him. He shifted his focus to the screen, where Lucy Gray continued to hum to her pets. Tessely disappeared behind the barricade, and Mizzen, Treach, and Reaper held their lofty positions. Clouds rolled in, portending a storm and creating a dazzling sunset. The bad weather brought a quick nightfall, and he had not yet finished his pudding when Lucy Gray faded from view, and a deep rumble of thunder shook the arena. He hoped for lightning to provide some illumination, but the heavy downpour that followed made the night impenetrable. Coriolanus decided to sleep in Heavensby Hall, as did the other four remaining mentors. No one except Vipsania had thought to bring bedding, so the rest arranged themselves in the padded chairs, propping up their feet and using book bags as makeshift pillows. As the rainy night cooled the hall, Coriolanus dozed in his chair, one eye half open for any activity on the screen. The storm obscured all, and eventually he drifted off. Near dawn, he woke with a start and looked around. Vipsania, Urban, and Persephone slept soundly. From a few yards away, Clemencia's large, dark eyes shone in the dim light. He did not want to be her enemy. If the snow fortress was about to fall, he would need friends. Until the snake incident, he'd counted Clemencia among his best, and she'd always gotten on well with Tigress, too. But how to make amends? Clemencia had one hand tucked inside her shirt, where she fingered the collarbone she'd presented in the hospital, the one covered in scales.
"Did they go away?" he whispered.
Clemencia tensed.
"They're fading. Finally. They said it may take as long as a year."
"Are they painful?" It was the first time the idea had occurred to him.
"Not painful. They pull. On my skin."
She rubbed the scales.
"It's hard to explain."
Heartened by the confidence, he took the plunge. "I'm sorry, Clemmy, really, about all of it."
"You didn't know what she had planned," said Clemencia.
"No, I didn't. But after in the hospital, I should have been there for you. I should have broken down the doors to make sure you were okay," he insisted.
"Yes,"
she said emphatically. But she seemed to relent a little.
"But I know you were hurt too, in the arena."
"Oh, don't make excuses for me." He threw up his hands. "I'm worthless, and we both know it." A hint of a smile.
"Almost. I guess I should thank you for keeping me from making a complete fool of myself today."
"Did I?" He squinted as if trying to recall. "All I remember is clinging to you, not necessarily hiding behind you, but there was definitely clinging." She laughed a little, but then became serious.
"I shouldn't have blamed so much on you. I'm sorry. I was terrified."
"With good reason. I wish you hadn't had to watch that today," he said.
"Maybe it was cathartic." "I feel better somehow," she confessed. "Am I terrible?"
"No," he said. "The only thing you are is brave." And so their friendship was shakily renewed. They let the others sleep while they shared the last cheese tart in Coriolanus's stash, talking of this and that, and even rolling around the idea of trying to set up an alliance between Lucy Gray and Reaper in the arena. Since it seemed out of their control, they abandoned it. The two would pair up together, or they would not.
"At least we're allies again," he said.
"Well, not enemies anyway," Clemencia allowed.
But when they went to wash their faces for the cameras, she loaned him her soap so he wouldn't have to use the abrasive liquid goop in the bathrooms. And somehow the small but intimate gesture let him know he was forgiven. No breakfast was provided, but Festus came in early to pass out egg sandwiches and apples in the spirit of camaraderie. Persephone beamed at him over her teacup. Now that Clemencia had lightened up, Coriolanus didn't feel as threatened by the mentor pool. They all wanted to win, but that was largely in their tribute's hands. He assessed Lucy Gray's competitors. Tesley, small and brainy. Mizzen, deadly but injured. Treach, athletic but still something of an unknown. Reaper, too strange for words. The last of the clouds rolled out with the sunrise. Dead snakes littered the arena, draped over rubble, floating in puddles. Drowned, perhaps, or unable to survive the cold, wet night. Some genetically engineered creatures didn't do well outside the lab. Lucy Gray and Tesley were nowhere to be seen, but the three boys in soggy clothes hadn't ventured down from the heights. Mizzen was sleeping, his body belted to the beam. As the other students filed into Heavensby Hall, Vipsania and Clemencia, who seemed almost normal, sent food to their tributes. When the drones arrived, Treach ate hungrily, but Reaper again brushed off his food, climbing down into the arena to scoop water from a puddle. Indifferent to Treach and Mizzen, who finally awoke, he went about collecting coral and cirque and adding them to his row. The other boys watched him warily, but neither engaged him, put off either by his eccentric behavior or the possibility of stray snakes. They were probably hoping that someone else would finish him off, but his work remained uninterrupted, and he returned to the press box when he'd tidied his morgue. Treach sat on the edge of the scoreboard, swinging his feet, while Mizzen mimed eating. Persephone responded immediately, ordering him a large breakfast. After a minute, Tesley showed up, her face pinched in concentration. She hauled out a drone that, while much like the original delivery craft, appeared slightly altered. She positioned herself directly under Mizzen. "Does she think that will fly?" asked Vipsania dubiously. "Even if it does, how can she control it?" Urban, who'd been scowling at the screen, sat forward suddenly in his seat.
"She wouldn't have to. She wouldn't need to if... But how did she..."
He trailed off, trying to puzzle something out. Tesley flipped a switch, raised her arms, and launched the drone into the air. It ascended, revealing a cable that connected the base of the drone to a loop on her wrist. Thus tethered, the drone began to fly in a circle about halfway between her and Mizzen. He looked down, clearly perplexed, but got distracted by the arrival of his first drone from Persephone. It dropped a chunk of bread down to him and made as if to return home as usual. Then a few yards out, it swerved and came back at him. Mizzen leaned back, surprised. He reflexively swatted at it, but it only passed over him, opening its claws to deliver a non-existent gift, and came in again.
"What's wrong with that drone?" asked Persephone.
No one knew, but at that moment, a second drone came in with water and a third with cheese. They too deposited their packets, only to hang around, attempting repeated deliveries. But the drones, which had been timed for a smooth airdrop, began to bump into one another and sometimes into Mizzen. The tail of one caught him in the eye, and he cried out, lashing at it.
"Is there any way for me to contact the game makers? I mean, I sent three more," said Persephone. "There's nothing they can do," said Urban in amusement. "She found a way to hack them. She's blocked their homing direction, so his face is their only destination."
Sure enough, as the other three drones arrived, one at a time, they malfunctioned in a similar fashion. Mizzen was their sole target, and what had seemed at first funny turned deadly. He got to his feet and attempted to flee down the beam, but they swarmed around him like bees to a honeypot. Having left his trident on the ground, he pulled his knife and attempted to fight them. But the most he achieved was momentarily knocking them off course. They weren't programmed to make contact with him, but as they ricocheted off one another, and his blade more and more collided into him, until they gave the appearance of an attack. Mizzen began to grope his way to a pole, the very one on which he'd left Tesley to her fate, but his knee would not cooperate. Frantic now, he took a wild swing at the drones, throwing his weight onto his injured leg, which wobbled and then gave way. He lost his balance and plummeted toward the ground, snapping his neck sideways on contact.
"Oh!"
Persephone exclaimed as he hit the ground.
"Oh, she killed him!"
Vipsania frowned at the screen.
"She's smarter than she looks,"
Tesley gave a satisfied smile and reeled in her drone, switching it off and giving it a loving hug.
"Do not judge a book by its cover," Urban chuckled as he tapped some gifts into his communicuff. "Especially if it belongs to me."
His glee was short-lived. While featuring the drone incident, the game makers had neglected to show the wider picture, in which Treach had climbed down from the scoreboard and through the stands, dropping into the arena. He seemed to appear out of thin air, making a gigantic leap into the frame and bringing his axe down on Tesley in one fell swoop. She had barely taken a step when the blade connected with her skull, splitting it open and killing her instantly. Treach leaned his hands on his knees, puffing with exertion, and then sat right on the ground next to her, watching the blood ooze into the sand. The drones arriving with a shower of food for her set him in motion again. He collected a dozen parcels and withdrew behind the barricade. Urban covered his moment of disbelief with disgust and rose to go. He could not escape Lepidus's ever-present mic, though, and barely managed not to snarl when he said, "That's it for me. Laugh a minute, wasn't it?" Then he walked off, leaving Persephone to expand on her regrets and her gratitude for the opportunity to be a mentor. "You made the top five," Lepidus beamed at her. "No one can ever take that away from you."
"No," she said, somewhat dubiously. "No, that's the kind of thing that sticks."
Coriolanus looked from Clemencia to Vipsania. "Just us, I guess." The three arranged their chairs in a row, with Coriolanus in the middle, while others cleared away the seats of the defeated. Lucy Gray, Treach, Reaper. Final three. Final girl. Final day? Maybe that too. Lucky made his entrance in a hat stuck with five sparklers. "Hello, Pan Am! Had this hat done especially for the final five, but they've been sending off their own sparks." He pulled two sparklers out of the hat and hurled them over his shoulder blindly. "Final three, anybody?" One of the sparklers fizzled out on the floor, but the second set a curtain to smoking, eliciting a high-pitched yipping sound and panicked footwork from Lucky. A crew member ran on screen with a fire extinguisher to handle the crisis, allowing Lucky to regain his composure. As his three remaining hat sparklers died, the number for sponsors and gamblers began flashing at the bottom of the screen. "The betting's getting hot and heavy. Do not miss out on the fun." Coriolanus's communicuff pinged healthily, but so did Vipsania's and Clemencia's.
"A lot of good it will do me," Clemencia murmured to Coriolanus. "He doesn't trust me enough to eat anything I send."
Lucy Gray had to be hungry, but he assumed she was resting in the tunnels. He wanted to send her food and water, both for sustenance and as a conduit for the poison. Since her last two opponents could easily overpower her, he had to do something to put the odds in her favor. For now, he could think of nothing but to keep the crowd on her side. When Lepidus approached him for his promised thoughts on Lucy Gray's performance, he laid it on thick. Coriolanus didn't know what it would take to prove to people she was not district if she hadn't convinced them by now. "I feel a great injustice may have occurred by her being not just in the reaping, but in District 12 at all. People will need to judge for themselves. If you agree with me, or even suspect I might be right, you know what to do." While the new barrage of donations hitting his communicuff was affirming, he didn't know how it would help. He could probably feed her for weeks on what he already had. But the only tribute moving around the arena was Reaper, who had descended from the press box, cutting off another large swath of flag on his way. Gaunt and unsteady, he teetered over to add Tesley and Mizzen to his collection, using the new piece of flag to cover them. With effort, he climbed up to the back row of the arena, where he dozed in the sunlight, rocking gently back and forth, his cape spread out to dry. Coriolanus wondered if he would soon perish of natural causes, if starving to death was a natural cause. He wasn't entirely sure. Was it natural if hunger had been used as a weapon? To his relief, Lucy Gray materialized just before noon in the shadows of a tunnel. She surveyed the arena and, judging it safe, stepped into the sunlight. The mud on the hem of her ruffled skirt had begun to cake, but the damp dress still clung to her. While Coriolanus ordered her a feast on his communicuff, Lucy Gray crossed to Reaper's puddle and knelt. She scooped up water, slaking her thirst and washing her face. After combing out her hair with her fingers, she twisted it into a loose knot, finishing just as a dozen drones entered the arena. She appeared not to notice them as she took a bottle from her pocket and dipped the neck into the puddle, collecting an inch or so of water. After swishing it around, Lucy Gray poured the water back into the puddle and was making to refill the bottle when the incoming drones caught her attention. As the food and water began to drop around her, she tossed away the old bottle and gathered her gifts into her skirt. Lucy Gray started for the nearest tunnel, but then glanced up at Reaper lolling in the stands. She changed course, hurried to his morgue, and lifted the flag material. Her lips moved as she counted the fallen. "She's trying to figure out who's left in the games," Coriolanus said into the mic that Lepidus had pushed in his face. "Maybe we should put it up on the scoreboard," joked Lepidus. "I'm sure the tributes would find that helpful," said Coriolanus. "Seriously, that's a good idea." Suddenly Lucy Gray's head shot up, and the provisions in her skirt fell to the dirt as she turned on her heel and ran. She had heard what the audience could not. Treach swung out from behind the barricade, wielding his axe, and caught her wrist as she passed under the beam. Lucy Gray twisted around, dropping to her knees, fighting wildly as he raised the axe. "No!" Coriolanus jumped to his feet, pushing Lepidus aside. "Lucy Gray!" Then two things happened simultaneously. As the axe began to fall, she flung herself into Treach's arms and clung to him, avoiding the blade. Bizarrely, they seemed to embrace each other for a long moment, until Treach's eyes widened in horror. He shoved her away, dropping the axe, and tore something from the back of his neck. His hand shot into the air, fingers gripped tightly around the bright pink snake. Then he collapsed to his knees and smashed it into the ground, again and again, until he fell dead in the dirt. The lifeless snake still clutched in his fist. Her chest rising and falling, Lucy Gray whipped around to locate Reaper, but he still sat rocking in the stands. Momentarily safe, she pressed one hand against her heart and waved to the audience. As the crowd in the hall applauded, Coriolanus let his breath out in a huff and turned to acknowledge it. He'd done it. She'd done it. With her pockets full of poison, she'd made it to the final two. She must have sheltered the pink snake in her pocket, just as she had the green one at the reaping. Were there more? Or had Treach beaten the final survivor to death? No telling. But just the possibility of another reptilian weapon made Lucy Gray seem deadly. While Lepidus ushered off Vipsania, who thanked the game makers through gritted teeth, Coriolanus sank into his chair and watched Lucy Gray reclaim her feast. He leaned over to Clemencia and whispered, "I'm glad it's us." She answered with a conspiratorial smile. As Lucy Gray flattened the wrappings and spread all her food out in a pleasing fashion, Coriolanus thought of their picnic at the zoo. Was she restaging it now for his benefit? Something tugged at his heart, and the memory of the kiss hit him. Were there more in his future? For a minute, he drifted into a daydream of Lucy Gray winning, leaving the arena, and coming to live with him in the Snow's penthouse, which was somehow saved from taxes. He'd attend the university on his plinth prize while she headlined at Pluribus's newly reopened nightclub, because the capital would agree to let her stay, and, well, he hadn't worked out all of the details, but the point was he got to keep her. And he wanted to keep her. Safe and close at hand. Admired and admiring. Devoted and entirely, unequivocally, his. If what she'd said just before she kissed him, "The only boy my heart has a sweet spot for now is you," was true, then wouldn't she want that too? Stop it, he thought. No one has won anything yet. She had polished off most of her food, so he ordered another round, a large one she could squirrel away and live off for the next few days, in case she just decided to hunker down and wait for Reaper to die. It was a good plan. Low risk for her, and inevitable if he stayed on his current course of rejecting all sustenance. But what if he didn't? What if he regained his senses and decided to eat the nearly unlimited sponsor gifts that Clementia could provide him with? Then it would come down to a physical matchup again, and Lucy Gray would be at a real disadvantage unless she was packing more snakes. When the drones had delivered her supplies, Lucy Gray sorted them and stowed them in her pockets. They hadn't seemed spacious enough to hold all the food and drink along with another snake, but she was awfully clever. He hadn't even seen her remove the snake that killed Treach. Festus brought Coriolanus and Clementia sandwiches at lunch, but they were both too nervous to eat. The rest of the students ate in their seats, not wanting to miss a moment. Coriolanus could hear whispered yet passionate debates over who would win the day. He could never remember people caring in the past. The beating sun began to dry out the arena, soaking up the shallow puddles and leaving only a few deep enough to drink from. Lucy Gray rested on a bit of rubble, her skirt spread out to catch the rays. The lull brought out Lucky, who gave a detailed weather forecast, including a heat advisory and tips to avoid related cramps, exhaustion, and stroke. The line at the lemonade stand outside the arena stretched long, and people hid under umbrellas or crammed into precious bits of shade. Even the dependable coolness of Heavensby Hall failed, so students stripped off their jackets and fanned themselves with notebooks. By mid-afternoon, the school had made fruit punch available, which gave a festive feel to the event. Lucy Gray kept Reaper in her sights, but he'd made no move to engage her. Suddenly, she rose as if impatient to get on with things, and retraced her steps to Treach's body. Taking hold of one ankle, she began to drag him over to Reaper's morgue. Reaper appeared to wake up the moment she touched the body. He leaned out and shouted something unintelligible, then hurried down from the stands. Lucy Gray let go of Treach and ran to a nearby tunnel. Reaper assumed the job of transporting Treach, placing him neatly in the row of dead tributes and covering him with the flag remnant. Satisfied, he made his way back to the stands, but he'd only just reached the wall when Lucy Gray ran out from a second tunnel, pulled one of the flag pieces off the bodies, and gave a holler. Reaper whipped around and ran at her. Lucy Gray wasted no time in vanishing behind the barricade. Reaper replaced the flag, tucking the fabric under the bodies to hold it more securely in place, and went to rest against a pole. After a few minutes, he seemed to drift off, his eyes closed against the sun. Lucy Gray darted out again, yanked one of the flag segments free, and this time ran off with it trailing behind her. By the time Reaper had come to realize her disruption, she'd put 50 yards between them. His indecision allowed her to widen her lead, and she dragged the flag to the dead center of the arena, where she left it in the dirt and made for the stands. Angry now, Reaper ran over and repossessed his flag. He took a few steps after her, but the exertion had taken a toll on him. Pressing his hands against his temples, he panted rapidly, although he didn't appear to be sweating. As Lucky's recent update had reminded them, that could be a sign of heatstroke. She's trying to run him to death, thought Coriolanus, and it might just work. Reaper staggered a bit as though drunk. Flag in tow, he made his way to his puddle, one of the few that hadn't dried up during the afternoon. He dropped down on his knees and drank, slurping until only a muddy sludge remained on the bottom. As he sat back on his heels, a funny look crossed his face, and his fingers began to knead his ribs and chest. He vomited up a portion of the water, then retched for a while on his hands and knees before rising unsteadily. Still gripping the flag in one hand, he began to walk in slow, uneven steps back toward his morgue. Reaper had just made it when he collapsed on the ground, dragging himself in line next to Treach. One hand made an attempt to pull the flag over the group, but he managed only to cover himself part way before he drew in his limbs and went still. Coriolanus sat frozen in anticipation. Was that it? Had he really won? The Hunger Games? The Plinth Prize? The girl? He studied Lucy Gray's face as she watched Reaper from the stands, but she had a distant look, as if she were far away from the action in the arena. The audience in the hall began to murmur. Was Reaper dead? Shouldn't they be declaring a winner? Coriolanus and Clemencia waved Lepidus and his mic away as they awaited the outcome. Half an hour passed before Lucy Gray climbed down from the stands and approached Reaper. She placed her fingers on his neck, checking his pulse. Satisfied, she closed his eyelids and tenderly arranged the flag over the tributes, as if she were putting children to bed. Then she went over and sat against a pole to wait. This seemed to convince the game makers because Lucky appeared, jumping up and down, announcing that Lucy Gray Baird, tribute of District 12, and her mentor, Coriolanus Snow, had won the 10th Hunger Games. Heavensby Hall erupted around Coriolanus, and Festus organized a few classmates to lift his chair and parade him around the dais. When they finally set him down, Lepidus hounded him with questions, to which he could only reply that the experience had been both exhilarating and humbling. Then the entire student body was directed to the dining hall, where cake and pasca had been provided for a celebration. Coriolanus sat in a place of honor, receiving congratulations and downing more pasca than was good for him. So what? Right now he felt invincible. Citeria rescued him just as his head felt fuzzy, ushering him from the dining hall and directing him to the high biology lab. I think they're bringing your girl over. Don't be surprised if they put you on camera together. Well done! Coriolanus gave her a spontaneous hug and hurried for the lab, grateful for the moment of quiet. He felt his lips stretching into an insane grin. He had won. He'd won glory and a future and maybe love, too. Any minute now, he'd have Lucy Gray in his arms. Oh, snow lands on top. It most certainly does. He forced his cheeks to relax as he got to the door and straightened his jacket to help conceal the tipsy mess he actually was. It wouldn't do, somehow, to let Dr. Gall see him like that. When he opened the door to the high biology lab, he found only Dean Highbottom sitting in his usual place at the table. Close the door behind you. Coriolanus obliged. Perhaps the dean wanted to congratulate him in private, or even apologize for abusing him. A falling star might one day have need of a rising one. But as he approached the dean, a cold dread washed over him. There, arranged on the table like lab specimens, were three items: an academy napkin stained with grape punch, his mother's silver compact, and a dingy white handkerchief. The meeting could not have lasted more than 5 minutes. Afterward, as agreed, Coriolanus headed directly to the recruitment center, where he became Pan Am's newest, if not shiniest, peacekeeper. Part 3. The Peacekeeper. Chapter 21. Coriolanus leaned his temple against the glass window, trying to absorb any bit of coolness it might have retained. The stifling train car had just cleared when a half dozen of his fellow recruits piled out at District 9. Alone at last. He'd been on the train for 24 hours without a moment of privacy. Forward motion was often interrupted by long, unexplained waits. With the fitful travel and the jabbering of other enlistees, he hadn't slept a wink. Instead, he'd feigned sleep in an attempt to dissuade anyone from talking to him. Perhaps he could nap now, then awake from this nightmare that seemed, by its tenacity, to actually be his real life. He rubbed his scabby cheek with the stiff, scratchy cuff of his new peacekeeper shirt, only reinforcing his hopelessness. What an ugly place, he thought dully as the train chugged its way through District 9. The concrete buildings, flaking paint and misery, baked in the relentless afternoon sun. And how much uglier District 12 had the likelihood of being with its additional coat of coal dust. He'd never really seen much of it, just the grainy coverage of the square on reaping day. It didn't look fit for human habitation. When he'd asked to be assigned there, the officer's eyebrows had lifted in surprise.
"Don't hear that much," he'd said, but stamped it through without further discussion.
Apparently not everyone had been following the Hunger Games, as he didn't seem to know who Coriolanus was or make mention of Lucy Gray. All the better. At the moment, anonymity was a condition greatly to be desired. Much of the shame of his situation came from bearing his last name. He burned as he remembered his encounter with Dean Highbottom.
"Do you hear that, Coriolanus? It's the sound of snow falling."
How he hated Dean Highbottom, his bloated face floating above the evidence, the tip of his pen poking at the items on the lab table.
"This napkin, confirmed with your DNA, used to illegally smuggle food from the dining hall into the arena. We picked it up as evidence from the crime scene after the bombing, ran a routine check, and there you were."
"You were starving her to death," Coriolanus had said, his voice cracking.
"Rather standard procedure in the Hunger Games. But it wasn't so much the feeding, which we overlooked for all the mentors, but the thieving from the academy, strictly forbidden," said Dean Highbottom. "I was all for exposing you then, presenting you with another demerit, and disqualifying you from the games. But Dr. Gall felt you were of more use as a martyr for the cause of the wounded capital. So instead, we had your recording bellowing out the anthem while you recuperated in the hospital."
"Then why bring it up now?" Coriolanus asked.
"Only to establish a pattern of behavior."
The pen tapped the silver rose next.
"Now, this compact. How many times did I see your mother pull it from her handbag to check her face? Your pretty, vapid mother, who'd somehow convinced herself that your father would give her freedom and love. Out of the frying pan and into the fire, as they say."
"She wasn't," was all Coriolanus managed. Vapid, he meant.
"Only her youth excused her, and really she seemed fated to be a child forever. Just the opposite of your girl, Lucy Gray. 16 going on 35, and a hard 35 at that," observed Dean Highbottom.
"She gave you the compact?" Coriolanus's heart dropped at the thought.
"Oh, don't blame her. The peacekeepers had to wrestle her to the ground to get the thing. Naturally, we do a thorough search of the victors when they leave the arena."
The dean cocked his head and smiled.
"So smart about how she poisoned Wovey and Reaper. Not really fair play, but what's to be done? Sending her back to District 12 seems punishment enough. She said the rat poison was all her idea, that the compact had just been a token."
"It's true," said Coriolanus. "It was a token of my affection. I don't know anything about any poison."
"Let's say I believe you, which I don't. But let's say I do. What then am I to make of this?"
Dean Highbottom lifted the handkerchief with the tip of the pen.
"One of the lab assistants found it in the snake tank yesterday morning." Everyone was baffled at first, checking their pockets to see if their own hankies had gone astray, because who else had been near the mutts? One young fellow actually claimed it, saying his allergies had been particularly bad and that he'd misplaced his handkerchief only a few days before. But just as he was offering his resignation, someone noticed the initials.
"Not yours, your father's. So delicately stitched in the corner. CXS. Stitched in the same white thread as the border. Part of the border pattern, really. So unassuming that you'd have to look carefully for it. But irrefutably there." Coriolanus never bothered to examine his daily handkerchief. He just stuffed one in his pocket as he headed out. There would have been a slim chance of denying the charge if the middle name hadn't been so distinctive. Xanthos. The only name Coriolanus even knew that began with an X. And the only person who carried it was his father. Crassus Xanthos Snow. There was no need to ask about the DNA test, which Dean Highbottom had surely run, finding both his and Lucy Gray's signature.
"So why haven't you made this public?"
"Oh, believe me, I was tempted.
but the academy, when expelling a student, has a tradition of offering them a lifeline, the dean explained. As an alternative to public disgrace, you may join the peacekeepers by the end of the day. But why would I do that? I mean, why would I say I would do that when I've just won the plinth prize to the university? He stammered. Who knows? Because you're that kind of patriot? Because you believe learning to defend your country is a better education than a lot of book knowledge? Dean Highbottom began laughing. Because the Hunger Games changed you, and you're going where you can best serve Pan Am? You're a clever young man, Coriolanus. I'm sure you'll think of something.
But I...
His head swam with Posca and adrenaline. Why?
Why do you hate me so much?
He blurted out. I thought you were my father's friend. That sobered the dean. I thought I was, too, once. But it turned out I was only someone he liked because he could use them. Even now.
But he's dead now. He's been dead for years, cried Coriolanus.
He deserves to be, but he seems very much alive in you. The dean made a shooing motion. Better hurry. The office closes in 20 minutes. If you run, you can just make it. And so he'd run, not knowing what else to do. After he'd enlisted, he made straight for the Citadel, hoping to throw himself on Dr. Gall's mercy. He was denied entrance, even when he pleaded infected stitches. The peacekeepers phoned down to the lab and were told to redirect him to the hospital. One of the guards took pity on him and agreed to try to get his final paper to Dr. Gall. No promises. In the margin, he started to scribble a note begging for her to intercede, but felt the pointlessness of the thing. He merely wrote, "Thank you." For what, he didn't know. But he refused to let her feed on his desperation. On the walk home, the congratulations from neighbors went like daggers to his heart. But the real agony began when he entered the apartment to the sounds of tin horns and cheers. Tigress and the grandmam had gotten out the party favors they used to celebrate the new year and had bought a bakery cake for the occasion. He attempted a weak smile, then burst into tears. And then he told them everything. When he finished, they both became very calm and still, like a pair of marble statues.
When do you leave?
Asked Tigris. Tomorrow morning, he said.
When will you be back?
Asked the grandmam. He couldn't bear to say 20 years. She would never last that long. If he saw her again, it would be in the mausoleum. I don't know. She nodded that she understood, then drew herself up in her chair.
Remember, Coriolanus, that wherever you go, you will always be a snow. No one can ever take that from you.
He wondered if that wasn't the problem, the impossibility of being a snow in this post-war world. What it had driven him to do. But he only said, I'll try to one day be worthy of it. Tigris rose.
Come on, Corio. I'll help you pack.
He followed her to his room. She hadn't cried. He knew she would try to hold in her tears until he left. Not much to pack. They said wear old clothes to throw out. They provide all our uniforms, hygiene, everything. I can only bring personal items that fit in this. Coriolanus pulled a box, 8 by 12 inches, about 3 inches deep, from his book bag. The cousins stared at it a long moment.
What will you take? Asked Tigris. You must make it count.
Photographs of his mother holding him as a toddler, of his father in uniform, of Tigris and the grandmam, of a few of his friends. An old compass with a brass body which had been his father's. The disc of rose-scented powder that had once lived in his mother's silver compact, wrapped carefully in his orange silk scarf. 3 handkerchiefs, stationery with the Snow family seal, his academy ID, a ticket stub from a childhood circus stamped with an image of the arena, a chip of marble from the rubble of a bombing. He felt for all the world like Ma Plinth, with her handful of District 2 memories in her kitchen. Neither of them slept.